This audio recording is protected under U.S. copyright laws. It is produced by Nichols Patrick CPE and provided by your state society of CPAs for your personal, non-commercial use. Further reproduction, distribution, or commercial use of this recording without written permission from Nichols Patrick is prohibited. Requests for permission to reproduce this material should be addressed to Nichols Patrick CPE, Suite A, 973 West Liberty Street, Hubbard, Ohio, 44425. Welcome to the Weekly Tax Update for January 3rd, 2012, our first program of the new year. And we begin with final regulations on cost-sharing arrangements, which, even though the IRS made a valiant effort, turn out to be incomplete in that the IRS has reserved a number of very important points for guidance to be issued later. Cost-sharing arrangements that are dealt with by these regulations are those arrangements within a controlled group, U.S. taxpayers and foreign subsidiaries, who develop intellectual property or develop research projects together and share the costs and also share the ultimate benefits. Such cost-sharing arrangements, of course, require pretty good cost accounting. The final regulations here provide guidance on the determination of and compensation for all economic contributions by all controlled participants of a cost-sharing arrangement in accordance with the arm's-length standard. For purposes of determining the best method of measuring the arm's length results of a cost-sharing arrangement and any related controlled transactions, the final regulations adopt the comparable uncontrolled transaction method. They also permit the specified income method, the specified residual profit split method, the acquisition price method, and the market capitalization method. The regulations clarify that research tools are to be treated as platform contributions, not as excluded make or sell rights. And if this terminology seems a little unfamiliar to you, it probably means you don't work with cost-sharing arrangements. But if you do work with cost-sharing arrangements, then you know what platform contribution transactions are, and you know that CSA is the generally used abbreviation. For purposes of determining amounts on a pre-tax basis, the final regulations clarify that the term open quote tax rate close quote means the reasonably anticipated effective tax rate for the pre-tax income to which the rate of tax is being applied. Thankfully, there are some examples added to the regulations illustrating that requirement and illustrating how those payments would be determined on a pre-tax basis. The final regulations add examples, make clarifications to guidance. They're much better, much more clear, and much more useful than the original proposed regulations back in 2009. Then, to help us implement all of this, the following day, in TD 9569, Treasury issues temporary regulations which implement the use of the differential income stream for cost-sharing arrangements. In the temporary regulations published the day before, they did everything but tell us how to do this implementation, and those are final regs. These are temporary regs, meaning that the IRS leaves open the option much more easily that these will be modified. The use of the differential income stream as a consideration in assessing the best method for a cost-sharing arrangement is the subject of these temporary regulations. IRS says they're aware that some taxpayers have been taking unreasonable positions in applying the income method by using relatively low licensing discount rates and relatively high cost-sharing discount rates without sufficiently considering the appropriate interrelationship of the discount rates and the financial projections. So, issuing the final cost-sharing regulations on December 16th, as we just discussed, provided guidance on preparing the financial projections associated with the discounted cost-sharing alternative and the financial projections associated with the discounted licensing alternative and on evaluating reliability considerations associated with the comparison. These temporary regulations provide further guidance on analyzing the interrelationship between the discount rate and the cost-sharing alternative and the discount rate for the licensing alternative. And it is evaluation of that difference that's really important here. Thanks for your attention. Let's move on to something that might be more interesting, more universally interesting. And this would be if you have a subchapter C practice. Obviously, the IRS is disposing of a lot of regulation projects to make their statistics look good at the end of the year. This is TD 9565, Final Regulations on Continuity of Interest Requirement for Corporate Reorganizations. And here, the IRS says that when measuring continuity of interest, In determining whether a proprietary interest in the target corporation is preserved, the consideration to be exchanged for the proprietary interest in the target corporation pursuant to a contract to effect the potential reorganization is to be valued on the last business day before the first date such contract is a binding contract. What is a binding contract? One that is legally enforceable. Why is the IRS concerned? Well, because people have been modifying contracts, calling them binding contracts, and then modifying them later, changing the consideration that the shareholders are going to receive, the shareholders of the target are going to receive. So modification, according to the regulations, modification of a transaction that preserves continuity of interest, that will not modify the effective date of the contract, is one which has the sole effect of providing for more shares or more money to the shareholders. Modification of a transaction that does not preserve continuity of interest is clearly one that would give the shareholders less money or fewer shares. That's really not hard to analyze, right? Next, we get final regulations modifying the return preparer penalty rules for purposes of the earned income tax credit. All return preparers, whether an individual or firm, that determine eligibility for or the amount of earned income tax credits and that fail to satisfy the due diligence requirements of the regulations are subject to a $500 penalty per occurrence under Code Section 6695G. The final regs here clarify that preparers who prepare a return or claim for refund but do not submit it directly to the IRS can satisfy the requirement to submit a completed Form 8867 by providing the form to the taxpayer or the signing return preparer as appropriate for submission with the tax return or refund claim. I envision here what the IRS has in mind is that you have tax preparers in an office who are simply doing the mechanical work of preparing a return, which they then hand to the signing preparer. So that person would get the information and prepare the 8867, and that person has satisfied their ethical requirements if they hand the signing preparer a completed Form 8867. A firm can be subject to this penalty if a manager knew or should have known of an employee's failure to comply with the due diligence requirements before the date the return was filed. And now from regulations to a decision of the U.S. Tax Court, TC Memo Decision 2011-289, Peter A. McLaughlin, an attorney who practiced law for over 20 years, and in 2005 and 2006 had income from his law partnership of over $300,000 in each year, but who claimed expenses that were not deductible on his personal return. The law firm had a policy of reimbursing expenses for business meals, automobiles, travel, entertainment, conventions that were clearly business-related. That written reimbursement policy specifically provided for reimbursement of reasonable travel, including expenses related to client maintenance and development, inter-office travel expenses involving an automobile, lease and rental automobile expenses incurred for client travel, business meals and entertainment were reimbursable if authorized and approved. Continuing legal education expenses were reimbursable if approved. That written reimbursement policy, however, was not enough for Mr. McLaughlin. He claimed about $100,000 a year more than the approximately $60,000 a year that the law firm reimbursed. Now, as the IRS sees it, if Mr. McLaughlin's other $100,000 of expenses were, in fact, reasonable business-related expenses, he would have submitted them to the firm, and the firm would have reimbursed them. So the firm reimbursed all the reasonable expenses. Mr. McLaughlin claimed more than that on a line on Schedule E on his return as partner's expenses incurred for the production of partnership income, and the IRS disallowed those. Only the expenses that were not reimbursed were really unreasonable. The IRS was willing to rely on the firm's determination of what was reasonable expense. So Mr. McLaughlin lost his deductions of about $100,000 a year. Plus, because he did not act with reasonable care and in good faith with respect to the underpayments, he is liable for the accuracy-related penalty, adding 20% to the amounts otherwise due. Next, another form in the IRS's relentless pursuit of offshore money, a Form 8938 for reporting foreign financial assets as required by Code Section 6038D. What is a specified foreign financial asset? any financial account maintained by a foreign financial institution, and, to the extent held for investment and not held in a financial account, any stock or securities issued by someone that is not a U.S. person, any interest in a foreign entity, and any financial instrument or contact with an issuer or counterparty that is not a U.S. person. Sounds like they're hot on the trail of some of the foreign hedge funds. In any event, in the reporting, in the instructions for the Form 8938, there are 11 questions and answers, definitions, a list of exceptions, and, oh, by the way, the threshold for who is required to report. The threshold here is an unmarried taxpayer living in the United States who has foreign financial assets of more than $50,000 on the last day of the year or more than $75,000 at any time during the year is required to report. Married taxpayers with double that amount are required to report. Married taxpayers filing separate returns have the same limit as an unmarried taxpayer living in the United States, but taxpayers living abroad have a much higher threshold. A taxpayer living abroad is only required to file this form if they have more than $200,000 in specified foreign financial assets on the last day of the year or more than $400,000 on any day during the year. You satisfy the presence abroad test if you are a U.S. citizen who's been a bona fide resident of a foreign country or countries for an uninterrupted period that includes an entire year, or a U.S. citizen or resident who's present in a foreign country or countries at least 330 full days during any period of 12 consecutive months. In addition, remember, such persons may still be required to file the Foreign Bank Account Report, the FBAR form, the TDF-90-22.1. Another form, another way for the IRS to ferret out the hidden assets. Do you have a client that's engaged in the trade or business of gambling? In that case, you'll probably be interested in Action on Decision 2011-06. In this decision, the IRS announces its acquiescence in a decision of the U.S. Tax Court involving Ronald Andrew Mayo. The tax court found that Mr. Mayo, who was a gambler who played the horses, was engaged in the trade or business of gambling, and that he could deduct his gambling losses only to the extent of his gambling winnings, but Section 165D, which imposes that limit, does not restrict deductions for gambling-related business expenses, such as transportation to the place to the gambling place, a subscription to the racing form, any additional information or special books or special training that Mr. Mayo might have received in connection with his trade or business of gambling could actually create a loss on his Schedule C. And that's the big news. A professional gambler can have a loss on Schedule C. It just can't be a loss that's created by gambling losses in excess of winnings. Next, we have a decision of the Third Circuit Court of Appeals involving a Pennsylvania utility company, the U.S. parent of a U.K. subsidiary, which was subject to a windfall tax. The windfall tax was imposed by the Labor government to make up for what it claimed was a bargain sale of a utility in a privatization transaction. The amount was 23% applied to a formula that effectively required the taxpayer to pay 23% on about 2.25 times a hypothetical net profit. The problem with the windfall tax is it did not meet the requirements to be an income tax. It was not a war profits tax, it wasn't an income tax, and it wasn't an excess profits tax. To be an income tax, there are some things that a tax has to be. There's a realization requirement that the tax is imposed on or after the occurrence of events that would result in the realization of income under U.S. law. The gross receipts requirement says the tax is imposed on gross receipts or an amount not greater than gross receipts, and then you add the net income requirement that computing the tax demands deducting from gross receipts the costs and expenses incurred in earning those receipts. So this was not an income tax calculation, therefore couldn't be an income tax. If it wasn't an income tax, then it wasn't eligible for the foreign tax credit. As simple as that. Our next item is the repair regulations, or the Section 263 Pren little a regulations We're going to mention them here, but there's a special program on the repair regulations. There's a companion to this podcast, a special podcast dealing only with these regulations, which take 112 pages as I printed them off from tax analysts. Let me give you just a quick overview here. The three most significant changes in the temporary regs affect the definition of materials and supplies, provide a de minimis rule for certain acquisitions, and they clarify the unit of property rules, especially as they apply to buildings. The definition of materials and supplies was changed to remove the requirement that to be a material and supply, tangible property could not also be a unit of property. While Treasury did not increase the $100 de minimis threshold, it did add a new method of accounting available for repairable spare parts, which are known as rotable parts. Then a special de minimis rule was modified to remove the explicit no distortion requirement and replace the related safe harbor with a de minimis expense ceiling cap. That, however, is limited to taxpayers with, quote, applicable financial statements, which are certified statements submitted to the SEC or some other federal agency, statements that are submitted to a regulatory agency, or certified statements that are submitted to banks for credit granting purposes. That leaves a lot of owner-managed businesses that may not have certified audits unable to take advantage of this special de minimis rule. I expect that the IRS will be forced to reconsider that, but time will tell. Finally, the change that's probably going to get the most attention involves the unit of property rules for buildings. These regulations adopt a new framework for determining the treatment of building improvement costs. Amounts paid to improve the building shell or one of eight specified building systems constitute capital expenditures, despite the general rule that the unit of property for a building is the building and its structural components. All costs incurred to improve these building systems are required to be capitalized. So even though they are part of the building, which is the unit of property, these are subunits of property and they're subject to special rules. Heating, ventilating, and air conditioning, plumbing, electrical, escalators, elevators, fire protection and alarm, security, gas distribution, and finally, any other system the IRS identifies in published guidance. So we're left with the building shell, the windows, the doors, the roof, as being part of the unit of property, which is the building. The other items, those things we may have thought were part of the unit of property, are now units of property to themselves, and any improvements to those must be capitalized. However, the rules get more interesting because if you have retired that, you're also given an opportunity to retire the undepreciated cost of the new improvement. So a lot of us are going to have to go back to school on the on how we deal with something as simple as whether to expense or capitalize an incurred expense. Last week or the week before, I told you about Revenue Procedure 2011-14, and at the time I speculated that there must be something in the works from the Financial Accounting Standards Board that had motivated the Internal Revenue Service to provide that particular guidance. And now we have Internal Legal Memorandum 2011-51-022. Here's the deal. If your company is required to change its, because of the accounting standards update, ASU 2009-13 or 14, because there's new guidance on how to separate arrangements that have multiple deliverables where you have bundled goods and services and the taxpayer receives advance payments for the bundled goods and services. The taxpayer presently defers the advance payments until the contract is complete for financial statement purposes and for tax purposes. New Financial Accounting Board standards, however, provide guidance on how to separate such arrangements with multiple deliverables, and the taxpayer is able to adopt the new standards for its fiscal year beginning after January 1, 2011. And the question posed in this internal legal memorandum is, can we just change our tax method of accounting to conform to our books? And the answer is no. A taxpayer who changes the method of accounting for its books must get the consent of the commissioner before computing taxable income under this new method. So I had a compatible method I had my books and tax were the same under the old rule. Financial Accounting Standard Board changed the rule, and I've got to change my financial statements, and I have to fill out a Form 3115 and send that off to the Commissioner of Internal Revenue to make sure that they are aware that I'm changing my method of accounting for tax purposes as well. It's not like we have to ask permission. It's an automatic change, but you still have to go through the paperwork. And finally, I have a group of taxpayers who got caught trying to cheat the government, in a word. This is Ray Feldman et al., Tax Court Memo 2011-297. The Feldmans owned an appreciated piece of real estate up in Wisconsin. If they sold the stock, they'd have about a $2.5 million capital gain. If they sold the assets, the corporation would have $2.5 million of depreciation recapture and capital gain within the corporation, which didn't do the shareholders any good. Anyway, the swing was about $750,000. So the taxpayers found somebody to buy the assets. They got the money for the assets. Now they're looking at a $750,000 tax liability, and along come some people from an outfit called Midcoast. And Midcoast is in the business of helping people avoid their tax. Midcoast Acquisition Corporation, owned 50-50 by Michael Bernstein and Honora Shapiro. Their deal is they will buy the stock of this company that has already sold its assets, that's looking right down the gun barrel for $750,000 of tax. They'll buy the stock of the company and give, because they intend to make the income tax liability go away, they will pay more for the stock than the shareholders would realize if they liquidated the corporation and paid all the taxes. And the Feldman family bites. Hook, line, and sinker. They buy the whole program, although the record is replete with references that should have rung alarm bells for somebody. What Midcoast did after they bought the stock was create a series of bogus paper transactions that made it appear that they had losses that covered all of those gains. And of course, they walked away into the sunset with a healthy piece of change, since nobody ever paid the income taxes. But the IRS caught on quickly. They disallowed all the sham loans, all the illegal distressed asset tax shelter, and they sent a notice of deficiency to Woodside Ranch, which the Feldman family had sold, right? Turns out that by the time Midcoast was done, Woodside Ranch had no assets. Where did the assets go? Well, indirectly, one way or another, the assets went out to the Feldman family. And the IRS says, we want our money. Are the members of the Feldman family liable as transferees? The tax court found that the purported stock sale between the Feldman family and Midcoast is, for federal income tax purposes, nothing more than a sham. And the sham transaction did not relieve the corporation of its liability. Therefore, the shareholders who got the money are transferees, and they have transferee liability for the tax, for penalties, and for interest. I'm sure this is not the outcome they envisioned when they entered into that transaction with Midcoast. Well, this has been a little longer than the typical program. Thanks for your patience. Welcome to a new year. Make sure you join me for the special podcast analyzing the new regulations on capitalization versus repair.